Fredericton, New Brunswick, he decided to put his money to good use. The former tech executive spent a year studying homeless outreach programs across Canada and the United States. He then bought a plot of land and began constructing 12 Neighbors, a gated community of 99 tiny homes aimed at providing affordable, safe, and stable housing for the homeless. Despite initial skepticism and bureaucratic roadblocks, LeBrun persevered, garnering local support while pouring $4 million of his own fortune into the project and securing government grants totaling $12 million. Each little house has a kitchen, bathroom, living room, bedroom, a small deck, and solar panels. Rent includes utilities and internet service and is calculated based on income. In addition, the community offers counseling and employment opportunities to residents who contribute to the neighborhood's maintenance and construction of new homes. LeBrun is also building a resident-run community center with a coffee shop, a teaching kitchen, a silk printing business, and giving residents even more opportunities to thrive. By using his wealth to create a practical and compassionate solution to homelessness, this millionaire is setting an extraordinary example of what it really means to live a rich life and leave a great legacy too. And this is Mandy from GoodNewsGoodPlanet.com.
This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem and me, Dave Johnson. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Ken Jones, Alex Gonzalez, Antonia Gonzalez, Isabel Charlet, and Roz Brown. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of tonight's newscast is available at our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Terrence Burns. All of our KBOO programs are made possible by the support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text to KBOO to 44321 and stay tuned now for News in Depth with Ken Jones.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Our in-depth guest today is Carolyn Dasher, author of the new novel, American Sky. The book tells the story of three generations of American women over the course of three wars, World Wars I and II and Vietnam. The novel has its roots in Carolyn's own childhood, growing up in a nomadic military family, and her fascination with the Women Air Force Service Pilots Program, WASP for short, a group of civilian women pilots in the U.S. who flew military aircraft during World War II. Writer Jenny Shortridge calls American Sky a powerful debut novel about three generations of gutsy mothers and daughters who defy norms while grappling with family, self, love, and war, ultimately learning to fly in every sense of the word. Carolyn will be launching American Sky in conversation with Joanna Rose tomorrow, Tuesday, July 1st, 7 p.m. at Portland's Bold Coffee and Books. We're happy to have her here with us to talk about the new book. Well, Carolyn, the new book is a historical epic, but has its origins in your own personal history, growing up in a military family. Can you tell us about that experience?
Yeah, so I didn't grow up in an airplane military family. My dad was career Army. He served in Vietnam. One of my brothers was Army Airborne, so he jumped out of planes, but he did not fly them. But I definitely grew up in a family where, you know, we were around military bases and military personnel, and there's just sort of a you know, there's just some interesting things that come with that life that I was familiar with. And back, oh gosh, probably about 10 years ago, someone who knew that about me and who knew that I was interested in historical fiction sent me an NPR episode of Radio Diaries that was about the WASP, the Women Air Force Service pilots in World War II. And I had sort of a vague notion about the WASP. I had heard of the WAVES and the WACS, and, you know, these are all these women's auxiliary military organizations before women were actually integrated into full military service.
Meaning they served as civilians. They were discriminated against and they weren't actually allowed in the military.
That's correct. They were discriminated against. And then in turn, these women's services also discriminated against other people. For instance, the WASP did not allow Black aviators to join. And so there were some incredibly talented Black female pilots. One is named Janet Herman Bragg, and she would have been a huge asset to the WASP, but she was not even considered. So yeah, even within those organizations, there was discrimination back then. But what struck me on that Radio Diaries episode, when I finally got around to listening to it, which took a while, was how proud and joyful these women sounded when they talked about their service in the WASP, when they talked about their time in the WASP. They were living, for many of them, they were living their life dream in that moment. And at the close of World War II, and there had been talk about actually incorporating the WASP into the U.S. Army Air Force. It was a joint service at the time. But as World War II wound down, there was this realization that all these men were going to be coming home from overseas and there weren't going to be enough jobs for them. And that's the same reason the women got sent home from all the factories where they had been working. The WASP were told to go home and get married and have children. And, you know,
that's quite a switch from the excitement of serving.
Right. And flying some pretty significant aircraft. And some of them weren't able to fly again after that. Of course, flying airplanes is not an inexpensive hobby, so you have to have some resources to be able to do it. Some of them found ways to keep doing it, and others didn't.
Now, since they were serving as civilians, though, and of course they performed only non-combat duties, and I think that was out of necessity, even there weren't enough male pilots to go around during the war, though, again, you said after the war, they weren't needed and they were kind of thrown aside because they were worried about the men having jobs. What exactly were those non-combat duties? You mentioned that they flew the actual combat planes, but not in a battle situation.
Right. They did not fly combat missions, but they did do some dangerous things. The thing they're most known for is ferrying aircraft from base to base or from factory to base. You know, planes come off the factory line and they have to get to where people actually need them. And so that's maybe the thing the WASP are most known for is ferrying planes. But they did other things too. They were a big part of this early drone research program where they would be flying these drones remotely. They were test pilots for aircraft that sometimes before male pilots flew them. And one of the really dangerous jobs that they did, and a job that I have the characters in my book do, is they towed artillery training targets. So the way that worked was they would take a plane up, usually at night. The female pilot is flying. There's a guy in the back of the plane who's spooling out this target cable. And down on the ground, there are artillery guys, AK-AKs, they called them, because that's the sound the gun makes, who are firing up at the target using live ammunition. They trained with live ammunition. And,
oh, my. That's extremely dangerous. That is kind of a simulated combat situation.
That's right. And so these were really skilled, precise flyers. And sometimes the AK-AKs on the ground were not skilled and precise. And sometimes they got hit.
There were casualties then?
Well, I don't know that there were actual... I know that planes got hit during the target towing practice. And there were certainly WASP casualties, WASPs who died on the job. When someone's flying a lot, things can go wrong with airplanes. So there were some who died, you know, while flying for the WASP.
Right. Well, I know there was it was quite a breakthrough for these women, and they were flyers before, weren't they, Carolyn? I mean, they had tryouts to join the WASP, as you have in the book, and that was a very difficult situation. I mean, there were thousands of women who applied, and maybe only a few hundred who got accepted, I think. And you have one character in the book, well, one of the main characters, she goes to a doctor to get a health check before trying out for the WASP program. And the doctor, who knows her and her family, says, women are too emotional to be trusted with airplanes. So that's what they had to deal with. And even though you said that they were considering the WASP program to be integrated into the Air Force, I read that women were not allowed to join the Air Force until 1976. So, like, over 30 years after the war.
That's right. That's right. There was a huge gap, you know, and that's something that I had also never really thought about before I wrote this book. Growing up in a military family, I had been around women in the ranks. There weren't a ton of them back then. There aren't a ton of them now, but they were there. They were around. I saw them, but I never really thought, you know, how did we get from this point in time where the WACs and the WAVES and the WASP were all these siloed off separate service organizations to women serving? And it was not a smooth road. It was not, you know, there was for the Air Force a huge gap in the amount of time women weren't allowed to fly. And, you know, some of the WASP, when they went back home, if they wanted and they tried to apply for jobs with the commercial airlines and were told, well, you could be a stewardess. You know, they call them stewardesses.
Right.
You can be a stewardess.
And these were very experienced pilots, you know,
exactly. Tolling
to serve drinks.
They had received the exact same training that their male counterparts received, ground school and in the air, very rigorous training. A lot of them washed out and didn't make it through. And some of the ones who washed out were great flyers. Maybe they had a bad day. Who knows? But if you didn't make the cut, you didn't make the cut.
I want to get directly to the book now. It tells a complex story, actually, covering three generations of women, mothers and daughters and their families, from the book start in 1908 through 1976. So it's a lot of ground to cover and a lot of characters. You must have started with research and then an outline. This is not the kind of book I think you sit down and they call them pantsers, you know, writing by the seat of your pants.
Yeah, it's funny how the book grew. I started with the two characters who become WASP, Georgianne Ector and Vivian Shaw, and they meet at WASP training camp and become great friends. I started with them and their story. And then as I went along and I was doing my research, my research lens somehow widened and I was reading more about women in war in general. And I came across accounts of combat nurses in Vietnam and the donut dollies or Red Cross girls who had also served in Vietnam and in World War II and possibly even in World War I. I'm not certain about that, but they may have. And these women experienced very traumatic things in the wars they served in. So I thought, well, you know, it's also generationally interesting to me that we have this World War II cohort. And then if they had children right after World War II, those children are coming of age as the U.S. is getting involved in Vietnam. And so you have this Vietnam cohort generationally. And then there's a matriarch of the family.
Right, Adele. So you go back to World War I for her, huh?
That's right. Who, you know, did home front stuff during World War II and lost a sibling in World War I, but of course didn't go over there herself. But her story was not as big a part of the book when I first wrote it. And my agent said, I want more of this character and we need to know how she became who she is, because she's kind of an iconoclastic woman. She likes repairing cars. She doesn't sew. She doesn't cook. She just wants to take apart an engine. And she's trying to raise her daughter to be like her, which is difficult in, you know, the early 1900s in northern Oklahoma where they live. So, yeah.
Now, Adele's daughter, George, who you mentioned, the book kind of started with her and her friend Vivian when they joined the WASP. I was really fascinated by how she got interested in flying, because you go back to when George was a girl in Oklahoma, Dell was her mom, and she first becomes interested when she sees a barnstormer at a county fair advertising plane rides for $3, which was probably a lot of money then.
Yeah.
And the barnstorming pilot turns out to be a woman. I was wondering, were those barnstormers the first women pilots?
That's a good question. I couldn't tell you who exactly the first female pilots were, but there were female barnstormers. And of course, the barnstormers did kind of a county fair circuit, you know, around the country. And they would do these amazing aerial acrobatics in their planes. And these planes were
early aircraft. Yeah.
Yeah. You might be frightened to get up to climb into one today, let alone let somebody fly you upside down and loop-de-loop around in it. There were a number of surplus planes after World War I that were called Jennies, and they were made of wood and cable and steel, and they were biplanes, open cockpit. So you had these barnstormers who were able to pick up these planes for not a lot of money after World War I and make money by doing these air shows, hopping around the country and doing air shows. And there were women involved in these shows. And so I thought, how fun to have Georgianne see a female pilot. And even though she's been raised by a mother who is unusual and thinks girls should be able to do whatever boys do, it never occurs to her until she actually sees a female pilot that she could be one herself.
That's her inspiration. Now, your launch event, Carol, is tomorrow at Portland's Bold Coffee and Books, and you'll be in conversation with Joanna Rose. For many years, Joanna, along with Stephen Allred, led Portland's Pinewood Table writing group. Do you know Joanna through the Pinewood Table, or did you just meet some other way?
Yeah, I was late to the game on the Pinewood Table, so I was not a member of the Pinewood Table, but I had met enough other Pinewood Table members that I knew of Joanna Rose. And so the Attic Institute was offering a fiction critique class a few years ago, and Joanna was teaching it, and I thought, well, there's no Pinewood Table anymore, but I can sign up for that. And I did, and we had a great class. We really gelled, and we continued working with Joanna after that class, just independently. And it's been a fabulous writer's education.
Yeah, what a privilege and a joy for you to be in conversation with Joanna, kind of a mentor for you at the launch event.
Exactly. I'm really honored that she's going to be up there with me, and I'm so excited to be talking with her about this book.
Carolyn, thanks so much for talking with us about American Sky. Wishing you a full house at Bold Coffee and Books tomorrow.
Oh, thanks so much, Ken. I really appreciate it.
We've been talking with Carolyn Dasher, author of the new novel, American Sky. Carolyn will be launching the book in conversation with Joanna Rose tomorrow, Tuesday, July 1st, 7 p.m. at Bold Coffee and Books, 1755 Southwest Jefferson in Portland. You can find out more about Carolyn, her work, and all her upcoming events online at carolyndasher.com. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. Through the bankruptcy sale of 23andMe, the pharmaceutical giant Regeneron is gaining access to one of the largest consumer genetic databases, the DNA information of over 15 million users. JB Branch is the big tech accountability advocate for Congress Watch at Public Citizen. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with him about 23andMe and what its data will mean for Regeneron and for the public.
First of all, what's 23andMe for our listeners who might not know that? And why are they selling to Regeneron?
Right. So 23andMe, it really started off as sort of that Ancestry.com flavor of consumer products. It was starting off as a way for people to connect to other relatives that they might have had out there. It was also being able to tell you a bit more about your genetic history. If you had, you know, a predisposition to diabetes, for example, or high cholesterol, or if cancer might run in your family. And so in order for them to do that, you had to provide them with a sample of your DNA, which was often done by folks into a tube, and then their lab folks did what they needed to provide you the information you needed. 23andMe came upon some hard times. Their sales started dropping. They even had a data breach not too long ago where Chinese and Ashkenazi Jews folks were being targeted, you know, with racist vocabulary and actions. To make a very long story short, they actually filed for chapter bankruptcy, chapter 11. And in that process, they started selling their assets. The most valuable thing that they had was that collection of DNA. And so they were able to sell that collection of DNA to Regeneron for over $250 million.
So what's going to happen now? What's Regeneron going to do with that? And how significant is it that they have access to that data?
Right. Well, Regeneron is a pharmaceutical company. They actually have their own DNA labs where they can run some DNA. And our thought process is that Regeneron is likely going to use 23andMe's user DNA database to provide either directly connected or targeted pharmaceuticals. They might be able to use the DNA to create new vaccines, new medications that could also be targeted to consumers as well. The big value to Regeneron in purchasing this DNA database from 23andMe is the profitability of it. They can create new products, they can target consumers, and again, they might even be able to make some new drugs or vaccines based off of the DNA that is stored in that database.
So they would argue, this is a great thing. We could really help people with this new data, right?
Yeah. So Regeneron is going to argue that they're going to keep your data safe, that this is going to be a win-win for everyone because they'll be able to cure so many diseases and things like that. They've even put out a statement saying that they will protect the consumer data. But what we find time and time again is that these databases end up being hacked, which obviously is a huge concern that already happened to 23andMe. And the other thing too, you know, there wasn't a renewed consent for the 23andMe consumers, right? For the users. So they had previously entered into a contractual agreement with 23andMe. They didn't anticipate that years down the road, 23andMe might file for chapter bankruptcy, chapter 11 bankruptcy. And they didn't anticipate a giant pharmaceutical company purchasing that information. It gives consumers a gross and icky feeling to think that the most intimate part of who you are, the essence of who you are, your DNA, might be commodified, purchased by a pharmaceutical company, and they might use a portion of that to profit off of you without you receiving any form of compensation.
So are there laws on the books that will protect people's personal information? Or maybe there are, but they're not enough?
Right. So that's the big gap that we need filled, and it's going to require federal legislation. It requires Congress to step up. You know, I'm sure many of your listeners are aware of HIPAA, which is patient privacy, but that's primarily with your doctors and health insurance companies, third parties, how they can use that. But HIPAA was written in the 1990s. And so HIPAA wasn't designed for a world in which there's artificial intelligence, for a world in which people are giving their DNA directly to for-profit companies. That just didn't exist in the 90s. And so a lot of what HIPAA protects wouldn't actually protect this type of situation. And so that's why we need Congress to step up and pass comprehensive data privacy laws. And I would specifically say a law that provides users a right to be deleted. so that if you have your data wandering out there somewhere with a company that you've formally either entered into an agreement with or were a user for, and now you no longer want to, you should be able to have that deleted automatically. And you should be able to reach out to that company and say, hey, look, I don't want you to have my data anymore. Please delete it.
Is this one of those, yet another one of those situations where the technology has moved too fast for the legislators and they just have to catch up?
In some respects, I mean, definitely that's the case with AI now coming into play, where there's all this DNA data that could be out there that could be sort of used alongside AI. But I would argue this has been a problem a long time coming. 23andMe isn't new. It's been around for quite some time. Ancestry.com has a similar sort of like DNA program. They've been around for a very long time. So it's more of congressional inaction as opposed to the technology being too quick.
And what about Regeneron's competitors? Are they pissed off, or do they feel that this purchase is unfair and should be stopped, or should have been stopped?
We certainly don't see anyone advocating for the consumer side aside from ourselves. I mean, you know, there's a lot of concern amongst the consumer privacy community. But from a corporate standpoint, you know, there aren't many big tech companies speaking out against this. And I think part of the reason why is because the healthcare market is huge. And all of that data is just so valuable. And so, you know, if you're an AI company, if you can get your hands on some DNA from a company that's going under, you might be able to, you know, take that data, incorporate it with your AI, and maybe come up with some new cures, maybe, you know, provide some new products. And that's the concern. It's a real slippery slope. I mean, once you start selling this data from one company to another, who's to say when Regeneron, if they were to file for bankruptcy, someone else purchases it, like, what are they going to do with that data, right? So you don't want this stuff trading hands time and time again.
Are there better controls on this type of situation in other countries?
Yeah. So in the European Union, I mean, they have a right to delete. And again, you know, that's any information online that's incorrect about you, you can have it corrected pretty quickly in the European Union. That includes when you have buyer's remorse and you decide, hey, you know, on second thought, I actually don't want this company to have my data. Please delete it. The EU is often considered to be, in terms of user privacy, one of the leading nations or countries when it comes to this.
How much influence does Public Citizen and other consumer-oriented groups have in Congress on this kind of issue?
Yeah, I mean, Public Citizen, we've been around for quite some time. We're a leading consumer rights organization. I think right now, this type of data privacy, it's not a, what I say is it's not a dinner table conversation, right? This isn't hitting your wallet. This isn't hitting the groceries, and it doesn't impact your ability to, you know, keep the lights on in your home. Those are the primary worries that people are having in this current economic environment. But what I will say is that, you know, data privacy impacts all of us. And this is a particular instance with this DNA. You know, DNA is, it's community oriented. If I provide my DNA, 23andMe is able to capture information about siblings, about relatives through your family tree and through your genome. That's how they're, you know, if you hear about these unsolved murder mysteries and they're able to, you know, crack open a case that's been silent for 40, 50 years, they're able to do that using DNA from distant relatives who submitted samples years ago who had nothing to do with the crime. So it's 15 million people who are implicated here, but it's 15 million people's family trees. So it's not just the person who submitted it, but it's likely a whole chunk of people within their family tree. That's why, you know, everyone should be concerned about this.
And anything else you want to add to what you've said?
For individuals who might have submitted their DNA to 23andMe, there was an opportunity to go to the 23andMe website and have your data deleted. When a lot of people rushed to the website, it actually crashed. And so some folks weren't able to have their data deleted. I would encourage folks to go back and try to have their data deleted. And if you find that you can't do it, I'd encourage you to reach out to state representatives, to reach out to congressional representatives and senators, because, you know, this issue is flying under the radar, and it's incredibly important. I mean, we don't want to be living in a world in which the most intimate aspects of ourselves, our DNA, our cells, are being sold around and profited on.
Yeah, you do hear people say that privacy is dead, you know, and there's nothing we can do about it. But you're saying, no, that's not true.
No, we can't give up that way.
That's J.B. Branch of Public Citizen speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. You're listening to KBOO.
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
Daddy, las mamas están aquí para darles información, música y diversión con el show de Mujeres Bravas, los domingos desde las 12 hasta la 1:30 de